Love how you comfort me. Leo laughed. That wonderful laugh the powerful ones use that sends shivers down your spine and makes magic dance on the air. There is no comfort in war, my Jane, nor in death. I would not attempt to comfort one who faces battle. There are only platitudes in words. Maybe I was still human enough to want platitudes, but I didn't say it. The corset style suits you well, he said. I reached up and touched the décolletage of the scarlet corset-styled top, designed by Madame Melisande Motiste du Les Mithrons. The golden lace was made from silk thread, as soft as heaven. My breasts were hefted high, making it look like I had a lot more in the boob department than I did, and my doubled gorgets were propped on mounded flesh. My black skirt was a fightin' formal, designed for dancing and weapons and battle, but on first glance looked soft and feminine. My combat boots, the red leathers, a brand new undergarment, and the white, buttery soft as pigskin moto jacket fightin' leathers were spread on the bunk, ready for the right moment to change. The leathers were backed with Dyneema fabric and hard plasticized armor between the layers. They were lined with silk, and there were defensive anti-spells woven into the entire thing. Both sets of leathers were adjustable, so that if I shifted into half-form, they would shift with me, stretching where I expanded and contracting where I shrank. But I wasn't wearing the leathers. Instead, I was dressed in sexy formal garb, weapons chafing my exposed flesh. The helo lifted away before I spoke, the artificial wind whipping the low branches and throwing sand. As it flew away, I heard the approach of the other helo. It was a staggered landing pattern, so the staff didn't have to reassemble every few minutes, and it had been going on all evening. But Leo's was supposed to be the last one. A surprise for us all? Someone unannounced. Someone to throw the entire Sangre Duello into total discord? Sure, why not? Sometimes I thought Leo was more cat than I was. I deliberately didn't ask about it. I said instead, I like the white leathers. They're different. But this will make a confusing impact.
True. And when you fight, you will be the only snowflake among us.
Snowflake? He was baiting me. Again, I didn't reply.
Though perhaps a well-napped white quartz blade might be a better analogy.
The helo's lights danced across the sand.
I know why you are so sad, my Jane, he said unexpectedly. Fear rides a red horse, its coat the color of blood, the color of battle and of loss. Fear is the greatest enemy.
I frowned as the new helo circled, the lights touching everywhere. I can't fight like everyone wants me to, I said at last. Falling into that Zen meditation that Eli talks about is hit or miss, and when I hit, I just slice people up. Like Callan. And when I don't fight in Zen, I lose bits of time.
You may not have to fight at all, nor might I. But if fight you must, then fight as you dance,
he said, his eyes piercing through the dark, his hair already curling in the wet air.
And as your cat hunts, you have balance and muscle memory and claws and teeth. You have deep perception of how an enemy moves and breathes, in the same way you sense how a dance partner moves and breathes, and what steps he may make next. I have seen you take in an opponent and gauge his or her frailties and weaknesses and strengths in the space between heartbeats. You have timing and stealth and joy in movement. All these things are yours by training and nature, my dark queen. Incorporate what you can, but do not try to change now. Fight your way. No European will expect such a thing.
He held out a hand.
Come, let us greet the last arrival.
If it's a suckhead, I hope he can bunk with you. We're out of room.
I fully expect at least one of them to lair with me.
Hmm. My mind cataloged the missing vamps as I put my hand into his and let him lead me to the line of waiting staff. The helo finally landed, and Katie stepped onto the sand. I watched as she leaped from the helo and threw herself into Leo's arms, and our hands were pulled apart. I turned and looked out over the water, to see bow and stern lights juddering up and down the waves. It was the first small boat ferrying the Europeans' food sources ashore. Blood servants. Human-ish people who had been drinking on the oldest vamps still undead, who had been around long enough to have seen more than one century roll around. Blood meals who wanted my people dead. People I might have to kill in order to stay alive long enough to see this blood duel through. I turned away from the helo and the beach and moved across the storm-wet sand to the house. At the bottom of the steps I spotted Molly, Eyeless, and Lakish. They were putting the final touches on the circle that surrounded the house, the new fire pit, and the traps built in here and there, the circles dug by hand with small shovels for the Hedge of Thorns 3.0. Their laughter was ripped by the wind, sending tatters of sound along the shore. The three witches had prepared other defenses on the island, things they hadn't told me about for two reasons, because they weren't sure how well they would work over salt water, and because Molly was afraid I'd depend on something that was iffy at best. They had three or four dependable defensive workings ready. The others were less reliable. They had one offensive working at their disposal, but using it went against everything they stood for. They'd use it only as a means of last resort. And again, they weren't talking to me about it. My job was hardwired and Wi-Fi security, fighting, killing, not witchy stuff. But there were things I hadn't told Molly. Things like the fact that I might have a brother. Things like Sim had been in New Orleans. But then I hadn't expected to have to tell her things until we were face to face over a nice cup of tea in her kitchen after all this was over. Molly wasn't supposed to be here. I stepped down to her, and Moll raised a hand, offering me a smile. It withered when I didn't smile back. She frowned and demanded, "What?" "Couple things. First, I'm afraid that Bansam Mlere may be on the island. Or make her way here." Molly might have paled slightly. Sim and Jack Shafru had access to a lot of black magic, and they had tried to control Molly's death magic. Sim had kidnapped Molly. Hurt Molly. Hurt her horribly. "Son of a witch on a switch," she swore. "When were you going to tell me that?"
"Never. You weren't supposed to be here."
Molly's eyes flashed with fire, and I almost turned tail and ran as she stalked up to me. Beast, her attention captured by the predatory posture, stared out at her.
"Molly is predator."
"Yeah, and scary." "You were protecting me?"
"Pretty much." I shrugged uncomfortably. "With you both on the island, you will be one of her prime targets. All she has to do is control your death magics, point them at Leo, and poof. Tidus has everything he wants. Or take out Leo and Tidus, and then she and Dominique would be in charge." Molly reached up and gripped my chin, turning my face down to hers. Softly, she said, "You helped me learn to control my magic. If Sim comes near me, I'll drain her. But you don't have your familiar with you."
Meaning that her control would be less than optimal. Beast took over and spoke through my mouth.
"Beast will be Molly's familiar if Molly Predator needs Cat. Beast is best big cat."
Molly stared into my our eyes.
"Fine. But don't keep things from me, big cat. Understand?" "The I-we of Jane and Beast understand."
Molly's expression went accusing, fingers tightening on my chin painfully.
"Don't think I didn't notice what you did there. Promise me you will not keep things from me. Promise me."
I blew out a breath.
"I promise."
"Beast promises."
"Good enough."
"What else?" I might have a brother who's nearly as old as me, a skinwalker. He works for Silad. Ma's mouth opened and closed. Well, she said at last, that sounds like a good story for when we're winding down from this crazy party. If I wasn't Prego, I might have had to send Big Evan off with the kids and open a bottle of wine. She squinted slightly at me. You and this brother okay? I think so. Or we're getting that way. Good. I want to meet him. Ma went back to work. My chin hurt where she had pinched it. Yeah, Ma's scary. I climbed to the porch. Alex was crouched there with his camera gear and Eli's night combat gear, cataloging each blood servant on the ferry boat and taking stills with the low-light and infrared cameras. Behind him was a cameraman, camera werewolf, with a shoulder-mounted camera. It was Scout, a werewolf I hadn't gotten to know yet, with a green Grindy on his shoulder. She snarled at me, looking stressed out with so many humans, potential victims of werewolf rage, around. Scout focused in on the side of the beach, and through his earbud I could hear Champ talking, giving the color or the overview or whatever you call it, in his pristine British accent. The leader of the werewolves was in a closet we had set aside for the production room slash security room, and it was pretty much wall-to-wall screens from every wall-mounted and shoulder-mounted camera on the island. There wasn't enough bandwidth to allow all of us comms equipment, but the island was so small we could likely hear a good scream from end to end. Every flaw, every flub, every wound and death, every single thing that happened for the next 2 nights would be filmed and sent out live in the pay-per-view agreed upon between Leo and the werewolves and Tidus. A lot of money riding on the pay-per-view, the gambling, and maybe documentaries after. I blinked the salt and grit out of my eyes and walked through the house, feeling tiredness in every muscle of my body, an ache in my middle that called for antacids. Bandit and Rocky were in the kitchen tasting things and making suggestions to Dion. Roe and Brenda, Katie's retinue, were bent over a schematic of security equipment, offering suggestions. The stink of vamp and werewolves and sex and blood and adrenaline were all mixed together in a gag-worthy stench. The house and the spit of land were too small for us all. Only hours until midnight. Our side could have used some sleep. I don't know what Tidus or his retinue were expecting when they came ashore and walked toward the steps leading to the house. Applause, bowing and scraping, tugging on our forelocks, which meant pulling the hair at the front of our heads. Surely he had expected fighting armor. What he saw as he approached was Eli and me standing at parade rest, not wearing leathers, but fully weaponed up with dual longswords, things that go bang, and 2 vials of holy water each. At my waist, I was wearing my sheathed Mughal Empire watered steel dagger, my gift from Bruiser. We looked like a walking advert for overlapping time periods, a take-no-prisoners duo from multiple eras, me in a 19th-century-style corset top and formal skirt, but wearing weapons, Eli in jeans and a muscle shirt with even more weapons, with bare feet. Eli and I also had our battle faces on, a bizarre, unwelcoming committee of 2. We'd been standing in place for nearly an hour in the moonlight as the EVs kept us waiting. Playing games already. The extended waiting period was being filmed by Scooter in the rushes and sea oats of a sand dune. It was a terribly boring job, so far. Tidus was a small man by today's standards, not quite 5 feet, 7 inches tall in his dress shoes and black tux. He was clean-shaven, his eyes a teddy bear brown, deceptively non-threatening, and his hair was worn in a modern style, not the old-fashioned one in the portraits I had seen. His power swept before him. It hit me, A burst of icy intensity, shattering across my flesh in a shotgun blast of energy that charred and froze at the same time. It would have brought me to my knees had I not been expecting it. In beast sight, it flashed on the fountain of the hedge of thorns in the sand. I was reminded of Leo's power the one time I had been standing close to him, when he was about to lose control, or else he was funneling all the power of all the vamps in his vicinity. One or the other. Or both. It had been the opening moments of a feeding frenzy, something I had no desire to ever see. Tidus's power was like that, but more. An exhibition, a demonstration, a painful shower of smoldering barbs that iced where they touched. I took a slow breath. Eli's eyes narrowed at his own discomfort. Tidus turned his head to scan the house. A gold chain glinted at his neck, dropping inside his collar. Gold on his fingers, at his wrists. A beach wind and the house lights caught his curls. I wanted to giggle, but kept it in for fear it would sound like, well, like a titter of fear. We stayed put as the group approached, blocking the bottom of the stairs, staring them all down. Staring down Tidus's enforcer, a hulky female Viking vampire named Glacy, though I suspected she had originally been a Gertruda or a Hilda. Staring down Tidus's primo, Taviano, one of the human warriors who had challenged me. Him I looked over and then ignored as they got close enough for them to see us clearly. Our block in the way was a pointed insult. Taviano put both hands on his swords, as if ready to cut his way through once they reached us. We still didn't move. The man who claimed to rule all the fangheads in the world was forced to come to a complete halt in front of us. Because this was Sangre Duello. Courtesy and vamp etiquette were distant rules that could be twisted and bent to intimidate or bewilder. Tidus looked us over, giving the boob flesh a pointed and condemning glance. But his attitude declared that Eli and I were beneath his notice. We still didn't move. Just before Taviano and his boss could react to the insult that the blocked stairs represented, Eli and I swiveled on our heels and stepped to the sides. From above us, Leo boomed, "Tidus, come on up, dude. We have beer." I slid my eyes to Leo. He was standing there in the same jeans he'd been wearing when he landed, a brown bottle in one hand, and he was barefoot, just like the 50s Americana I had suggested. Katie was by his side, wearing a billowy dress and flops, and an expression that tried hard to appear excited, despite her role as inelegant, unsophisticated, and vaguely vulgar. "We have an entire keg of beer." I was sure Katie hadn't had a beer in centuries. The whole sentence sounded strange in her usually sophisticated mouth. Tidus's face went paler than vamp normal. His mouth opened, his eyes went human wide, not vamped out wide, and his power stuttered and fell. "Beer," Tidus repeated. And then he barked a torrent of French and what might have been Italian to Taviano, shock and anger in the tone, insult, confusion. "Come on up," Leo shouted again, and the MOC in his air turned and walked away from Tidus, Katie's flops flapping against the wood porch. The three cameras caught every word and gesture. If I survived the night, I'd have to watch this someday. The MOC and Katie had succeeded in gaining the initial emotional upper hand. Point one to Leo. And then I caught a whiff of lemons and a glimpse of the woman closest to Tidus, Julieta Tempest, bloodmaster of Clan de Citron. Behind her was Dominique. Beast leaped to the front of my brain. "Enemy," she thought at me. Yeah, enemies. All of them. I stared at Julieta, and when she looked up, I grinned at her, showing too many teeth, my eyes glowing gold. She faltered, and I laughed, my voice a low growl. At the sound, the Europeans tightened around Tidus, a group of men close to him, and the semicircle of women behind. The Emperor stepped through the residue of Hedge of Thorns 3.0, his individual power signature sparking in Beast's vision as a dotted line of energies. And then something happened. I wasn't sure what, just something different, unexpected. Magic raked across me, familiar, gray and black with motes of red. The magics in my middle reacted, speeding up in the Vitruvian pattern of the star within me. And then it was gone, and I wasn't sure what had happened. Except that Tidus had done something, and then that thought slipped away. The front room was full of casually dressed humans, reading, speaking into their cells, thumbs flying as they sent texts. Two guys were stretched out on the rug on their stomachs, a spirited game of checkers between them. Not the dignified game of chess enjoyed by most older vamps, but gauche American games. Beer bottles were everywhere. The first two rows of a pyramid of beer cans had been built at the base of a window. Dion shouted from the kitchen, his island enunciation like honey and whiskey. Tidus, honey, come and get yourself a corn dog. We got us three kind of mustard to dip it in. Dion demonstrated dipping a corn dog into a small container of Grey Poupon and biting off the end. It was a decidedly sexual act. Dion, at his most amazing, putting on a show, the kind he had performed at Katie's Ladies when he chose to participate in the evening entertainment. Chewing, he pranced out from behind the Carrera marble-topped island while waving the Emperor and his peeps over. The chef was dressed in feathers, spangles, and rhinestones from head to toe, an outfit that looked like a love child of Bollywood and Brazilian Rio Carnival. I thought Tidus, the homophobe that history had never gotten right, might stumble. In Rome, sexuality and sexual expression had been far more open and varied than in modern times, but Tidus had never participated. More Pope than Playboy, judging from his expression. The Emperor was still a straight, conservative man. "Grab your corn dog and beer and come on up, Hoss." Tex stood at the bottom of the next flight of stairs, Brute beside him. The white werewolf was staring at Tidus, panting, salivating, as if he might want a little taste. "We got us some fighting to do." Dion held out a carnival treat on a stick, daring Tidus. Tidus reached to accept the corn dog, and Taviano stepped between them. Dion smacked the dog down onto a paper plate on the island and put both hands to his hips. "Sugar. If I wanted to poison the kinky sort, I'd do it in Earl Grey tea, not in a corn dog. That would be downright sacrilegious." Dion picked up the paper plate and slapped it against Taviano's chest. "Now you take that food and you eat it." Ziggy slid a hand around the stunned Primo to whack a bottle of beer into Tidus's hands. Tidus's secundo leaned in and whispered something in that foreign, Italian, Frenchy talk to the king, then led him up the stairs. Dion grinned evilly. He'd been having fun. From behind me, Ziggy said, "Honey, if I'd known you were going to play, I'd have put on Queen Bitch and helped. That looked like fun." "It was," Dion said. "What that old dude deserved." Tidus's shoulders went back and he stepped up the stairs, straight toward the lens of a camera and into the view of the world. Leo, with a faintly pleased smile on his face, followed. Katie winked at me as they passed. Winked at me. Point two to Leo. And to Shakespeare. Leo's opening salvo had been stolen from Petruchio, his own Kate by his side. I grinned suddenly, showing a lot of teeth. I couldn't have been prouder. This was the stolen theme from Taming of the Shrew. Roe and Brenda, wearing jeans and sweatshirts, followed Katie and Leo, and then the rest of the Nola retinue. This little show was surely my fault from way back when. Go me. Chapter 17. Stuck his nose in my crotch. We were standing on the third floor, the windows open to the cool night breeze, the corroded fans turning overhead. The air smelled of salt, smoke, and vamp, a weird mixture of herbs and blood and sex, poorly hidden beneath the wonderful aroma of food. On the table set aside for heavy hors d'oeuvres were more corn dogs, a slow cooker full of beanie weenies with Louisiana hot sauce, pigs in a blanket, and three plates of deviled eggs, each a bit different, and one made with that green horseradish-like stuff they use in sushi. There were two kinds of slaw, one made with ginger and soy, and lots of fixings, including pickled okra, pickled beet, pickled pickles, and corn on the cob, buns, and a massive, monstrous bowl of boudin, big enough to bathe in, sitting atop a platter of crackers. On the platter beside it, there was a whole barbecued pig and at least 10 bottles of various kinds of hot sauce from all over the South, including two featuring the Carolina Reaper, the hottest pepper in the world, created by Puckerbutt in South Carolina. I picked up the bottles to see I Dare You Stupid and Reaper Ratchet Sauce. It might have been my imagination, but my hands tingled from the peppers, even through the glass. If the table didn't catch on fire from the sauces, it might die from the weight of the food. Pretty sure I heard it groaning as I stepped away. The bar had been set up near the back of the room. There were 5 huge buckets full of ice and beer bottles, the aluminum leaking condensation onto newspapers placed on the floor. No colas, no water, no juice, no fancy wines. On a table beside the bar was a churn of homemade ice cream, double chocolate brownies, and the fixings for s'mores to take outside to the fire pit, which was blowing on the wind and smoking up the joint. To my right, I heard the werewolf pack leader, commentator, describing the food as regular old American picnic in the moonlight. Champ had a way with words. "Dion," I muttered, "you are amazing. A wonder chef. You need your own cape." "Only if I get a magic wand, too," Dion said from behind me. "Oh, wait." He put a finger to his lips. "I have a magic wand." He gambled away, his buttocks bouncing. "I may have to stab out my eyes," Eli whispered. I gestured with my head to the Emperor. He was eating a corn dog. On international paid TV. On his plate was a wasabi deviled egg and a mound of boudin. A squirt of hot sauce was curled atop it. I had a moment to wonder if that was the Puckerbutt sauce and if the fanghead king would go up in flames if he ate some. I could wish. Vamps didn't eat human food often. I had a feeling Tidus wasn't prepared for modern spices, and that Dion had prepared for that lack of familiarity with as much care as he had prepared his costume and attitude to irritate a homophobe. Tidus scraped a mess of boudin onto a cracker and took a bite. There was a funny sound, a sort of an inhale-groan gasp. A dozen of the king's humans surrounded him, hiding him from view. Leo saw it and slipped to the side, giving someone a tiny finger wave, his index finger lifting and falling. A warning. My eyes followed the MOC for a moment as he stepped behind the dessert table and picked up something. The tips of his swords appeared below the table, one on each side, mostly out of sight. The film crew stepped back. The EV Emperor's humans were all traditionally gorgeous. The males all wore tuxedos. The women were dressed in conservative black dresses, hems to the floor. Yeah, Tidus was still hung up on sexual expression, lifestyles, and activities. Leo knew Tidus's sexual proclivities. Of course he did. And Leo, with Dion, had set all this up maybe months ago as part of whatever other strategies he had percolating in his multi-level long-view 3D chess game of politics' devious mind. A wave scent of humanish blood washed through the room and out on the salty wind. The magic in the fighting chamber changed. Leo, weapon still out of sight, began to slowly vamp out. Katie in her sundress appeared at Leo's side, her bastard sword in a two-hand grip. Edmund appeared beside me, close enough for me to hear the soft pop of displaced air. G stepped to my other side. I could smell Eli somewhere close but didn't turn to look. His humans backed away from Tidus, then the vamps forming groups, females and males. The Emperor stood there, cold and unamused, his mouth burned red at the corners where he had bitten into the puckerbud sauce, and it had scalded him. He was armed with two swords just like Leo. "You parley with your ruler without the respect," he said in stilted English. At the words, all his vamps drew their blades. I tried to figure out why, and realized Tidus was using treaty-making wording, not sangre duello terminology. Brandon, wearing a tux, unlike the rest of us, stepped forward. Calmly, he said, "There has been no parley called. Parley was made null and void when the signs of Tidus Flavius Vespianus, Emperor of the European Mithrans, came ashore on the territory of Leo Pelissier, without legal writ from the master of the city of New Orleans and the greater southeast, in violation of immigration laws of the United States of America. Said scions acted without proper honor and outside of the Vampira Carta in leading attack on the scions and humans of New Orleans." My eyebrows went up. That was a mouthful of legal mumbo-jumbo. Brandon finished with, "There is no treating. There is no parley. This is sangre duello." Brandon stepped back. "You play silly games," Tidus said to Leo. He lifted his arms high, the steel edges of his long swords glinting in the overhead light, the silver plating on the rest of the blades flashing. He was wearing armor imbued with so much magic that it glowed in beast sight. "You have challenged the Emperor of the Mithrins and the Naturaleza. En garde!" Our vamps darted in. Our humans scrambled away. Leo, still in jeans, moved around the table, blades bared, his two besties at his sides. Katie vamped out. Gregoire moved with a dancer's grace, lending balletic beauty to the three of them. The expression on Leo's face said he was ready to fight. The agreements as to the order of duels be damned. His sword started to spin. Gregoire's blue eyes narrowed. The three looked deadly, but Tidus's people spread out, blocking the stairs. Others faced our humans ready to engage, a barroom brawl to the death. More weapons were readied on both sides. The EVs had been looking for an opportunity to attack and end it all quickly. The filming continued, and the camera crew were speaking to one another through their short-range headsets. One tripped, hit the floor with an echoing thump. Tidus whirled on him, sword up. What did Tidus benefit by pushing this to the finish right now? And then a tingle of magic brushed across my skin. Was Tidus wearing an amulet treated with a mind spell? I didn't know and couldn't take a chance. I drew on Beast's scream and shouted, "Hold!" Everything went still as the word echoed in the rafters. Leo blinked, his face startled, though he didn't look ticked off at me, so that was good. But I had no idea what to do now that I had their attention, a skinny girl holding a ceremonial sword that would be useless in any real battle. Flying by the seat of my pants, again. But at least the ratcheting up of aggression had stopped. "I demand," the word came to me only a beat too late, "redress. This human," I spoke the word as if it were an insult, and pointed my Moogle blade at Tidus's primo. "Little Tavi has challenged the enforcer of the master of the city of New Orleans. I have accepted his challenge, and I will not be denied." All my weapons sheathed except the curved Moogle blade, I advanced on Taviano. My enforcer stepped between us.
This challenge by this human child is mine to take, my mistress,
G said, enunciating like an actor in a pre-sound system play. At his statement, the camera wolf man rolled out of the way, to his feet and out of danger. G drew his swords.
I would not have you sully your blade with the weak, watered-down blood of this human creature.
Beast chuffed.
Sully is good word, but humans like meat with watered-down blood. Sully, you dare?
Taviano ground out, swords bare, advancing on G and me.
Enough!
The word shook the rafters and made the overhead fans sway. Sabina elbowed a vamp and two humans aside as if they weighed nothing and stepped between us, her magic hot and frozen all at once, making the space we occupied seem too small, too tight, airless. The place fell so quiet that I could hear her white, starched clothing swish. Her hands were hidden in the skirt's copious pockets.
The Outclan priestess signed the final agreements, thus I am both final witness and judge.
Sabina pulled her gloved hands from her pockets. In one was a 7-inch-long sliver of wood, sharp as a stake on one end and worn smooth on the other. The energies in the room went sideways, hot, cold, smoky, sour, with magical glints of pale gold and motes of fearful black. The stench of the undead increased, the sickeningly sweet smell of funeral flowers and dried herbs and lemons. The weapon Sabina held up was a big sliver of the blood cross, the historical, cursed, magical origination element of the vamps. This one was smaller than the cross-shaped section that had charred the priestess's hand to the bone, but was still larger than any other piece I had seen. Where had she gotten it? I'd once peeked into her hiding place, inside the sepulcher where she might or might not sleep by day. I hadn't seen this one, and I had kind of ruined the tiny one she had loaned me when it had been absorbed into the glob. Sabina held the holy cursed wood over her head, and people backed away, leaving only the main challengers, the TV crew, and Sabina in the center of the room.
Vespianus, she said. So speaks the Outclan priestess. You raised weapons against the titular challenger out of order. Felicie, you raised weapons as well, though in what might have been defense. The primary contenders will both take places on either side of the room. You will not speak unless I give you leave.
Her hawk-sharp gaze pierced the room's occupants, and I had a flash memory of my high school librarian, a stern-faced woman who had carried a ruler to smack tables with, if not students' hands.
Your people will separate and sit. Vespianus's people, there.
She pointed to her left.
Pelissier's people, there.
She pointed to her right. No one moved. Sabina dropped her hand and pointed the splinter of the blood cross at Titus Flavius Vespianus, holding it like a wand in a Harry Potter movie.
Now!
Titus's people moved back, human feet sliding on the floor, vamp feet silent. As they shifted position, so did Leo's people, until there was a 20-foot space between them, then 30. The fighting rings were exposed where there had been only people before. Titus sat on a bench, looking regal but stymied. So did Leo, looking ticked off.
All combatants in the first 3 rounds will dress in fighting armor and return,
Sabina said.
I allow you 5 minutes, no more. Go.
People dashed down the stairs or popped out of sight. No one remaining on the third floor moved. The vamps doing that still as marble thing. Common among the undead. Only the humans and wares and I breathed. I slipped down the stairs last to dress in the white armor. About halfway down the stairs I realized the corset was tied in back. Fortunately, Dion joined me and unlaced the corset top, helping me into my fighting clothes. I turned on beast speed and the costume change, as Dion called it, took only 2 minutes. In a little over 4 minutes, we all began to return to the third floor. I hoped that wearing the girly clothing and now the white leathers made people think I had no fighting skills. First impressions and all that. At exactly 5 minutes, Sabina turned her head in one of those bizarre, squeaky motions that was more lizard than human, and looked around the room. "You," she said, pointing at Shiloh and drawing a piece of paper from a pocket in her robes.
"You will read the order of trials and announce the combatants. The first will begin now."
Sabina sat down on a bench, her skirts scratchy in the quiet. Shiloh slid between vamps and humans. Her face was too calm for this summons to be unexpected. Shiloh, part witch, part vamp, had been planning stuff with the vamp priestess. This shouldn't have been a surprise. The position of outclan priestess had always been held by a witch or shaman turned vamp, and Shiloh fit the bill perfectly if she turned down a place in Clan Yellow Rock. Dang, something else I'd need to address if I lived through this. Shiloh took the paper and unfolded it. "First challenge," she said, "is from Conchetta Gallo to Jane Yellowrock. Challenger and challenged, approach the central ring." I started to walk in, but G beat me to it.
"I accept the challenge for the enforcer of Leoplicier, master of the city of New Orleans."
"And by what right do you accept the challenge?"
Sabina asked. A happy, sly look on his face, G. D. Merci, the misericord of the New Orleans vamps, said,
"I am the enforcer of Clan Yellow Rock."
"Clan?" Titu shot to his feet.
"This is an outrage. No human can be a blood master."
Sabina stared at him. For a moment, nothing happened. The Emperor had been told not to speak by an outclan priestess. Kings were important. If they rallied their people, they could kill a priestess true dead. One-on-one, priestesses were more powerful. Tidus went quiet, drawing his dignity around him like a cloak. He bent his head slightly in a royal nod.
Sabina said, "Do you wish to address a point of order? If so, you may speak."
"Yes, sir. I contest the concept of a non-Mithrin as a blood master of a clan."
Dressed in fighting armor, Edmund stepped next to Xi. To Sabina, he said,
"Permission to speak to this point of order."
Without taking her eyes from Tidus, Sabina nodded. Edmund said,
"I am Edmund Hartley, a Master Mithrin, formerly Bloodmaster of Clan Laurent. My clan, given by Covenant to Bettina, now Master of Clan Laurent."
"Wait, Covenant? What Covenant?" I demanded. Edmund continued speaking.
"I am also heir to the Master of the City of New Orleans, and heir of Clan Pellissier. I speak as one of power. Only days ago, Jane Yellowrock completed a blood binding upon me, a Master Mithrin, making me, according to the Vampira Carta, her primo."
Every single vamp on the far side of the room inhaled in shock. Good thing the windows were open, or there'd be no air left for the humans. For myself, I'd forgotten to breathe. I hadn't wanted to claim Edmund. It had been the only way to save his life. Ed said,
"Such a binding gives Yellowrock the right to be appointed as a clan master. Jane Yellowrock is now master of Clan Yellowrock, and I am now her primo."
Coldly, Tidu said,
"A master of Mithrin, heir of massive territory, in the position of servant. No, this is absurd. I will not allow it."
"The outclan priestess allows it,"
Sabina said, her words cutting. Tidu started to speak again, but Sabina went on.
"To the challenged is the choice of weapons."
Xi said,
"Dual swords, no shields, smaller blades as desired."
"To first blood or to death?"
Sabina asked the combatants. Someone at the back of the room answered, "Blood."
Blades and First Blood. Begin.
Everyone stepped back except Xi, wearing metallic painted plasticized armor and Conchetta Gallo. The tiny woman, shaved-headed, olive-skinned, looked 14, though she was over 200. Her armor was silver-green and shiny, and she was a master swordswoman. The combatants crossed swords, gave half-bows, and from somewhere a single bell tone sounded, echoing in the ceiling. They attacked. Blades clashing, glinting, flashing, they advanced and withdrew. Danced the Spanish circle around the octagonal fighting ring. Xi cut, a controlled transfer of weight and balance, so smooth it looked as if nothing had happened. A deep cut sliced the woman's face, bisecting her cheek from ear to nose. Instantly it bled in a drench, as all head wounds do, the flesh already swelling and drooping to expose bloody teeth through the wound. They both stepped back off the ring, but not as if they wanted to, not as if they trusted the other to abide by rules of First Blood. The bout had lasted all of 5 seconds, maybe just 4. One of the film crew cursed softly, presumably at the speed.
Fast, Beast said inside me, entranced. Want to fight fast with steel claws.
Brandon said, Results of this duel are acceptable to the Honorios.
Sabina said, Next round's a pace, now that Pellissier has drawn first blood.
She looked to Shiloh.
Go the next 3 bouts, which shall take place, as Americans say it, back to back.
No,
Tidus said, adding what sounded like, Es una locura.
Then in English he added,
This is mayhem. Unacceptable.
We waited while someone explained to Tidus that the phrase meant the bouts would follow one after the other, not with the fighters standing back to back while battling. Tidus shook his head and rattled off more foreign words before adding,
Following a disfarce, it will be a privilege to teach the Americans their place in a restore proper order, a decorum, and protocol to these neglected shores.
As insults went, that was a good one. I wondered if Tidus had crib notes in his hand. Wisely, I didn't ask that question. Leo narrowed his eyes, but he didn't speak either. That might have had something to do with the film crew, or with Bruiser's hand on his shoulder, holding the MOC in his seat, or play-acting. Leo had planned for this night for maybe centuries. Shiloh said,
Nimbolio Mancini challenges Jane Yellowrock. Simon Costa challenges Jane Yellowrock. Lambros Alafausos challenges Eli Younger.
My heart took a dive. Lambros was a 300-year-old vamp. He was a killer through and through. Eli was dead. I started forward, but someone held me back. The irony of Leo and me both being held back wasn't lost on me. I snarled and jerked my arm free, but waited.
Xi said, The honor of facing Nimbolio Mancini is mine.
Sounding like a bored roué, Edmund said,
I shall die of the tedium, but the honor of facing Simon Costa shall be mine.
The way he said honor let me know that Edmund and Simon didn't like each other much.
My name is properly pronounced Simone,
the man said to Edmund,
as you are well aware. And though it is a dishonor to fight a former slave, I accept the humiliation of this belt, out of great regard for my master and emperor.
I was watching Edmund's undead face. Yeah, he'd been a slave, and though his expression gave nothing away, that history was still a hard pill to swallow. A voice from the stairs said,
The honor of facing Lambros Alafausos is mine.
I spotted Caun ascending to the 3rd floor. He wore no armor and was mostly naked, wearing only a loincloth, his body tattooed with blue and black dye in what was said to be Celtic symbols.
I am the chief strategist of Clan Yellow Rock, he said, as a cameraman stepped around him, getting the full 360 front and back. No one may gainsay me. Count stepped up to me and dropped to one knee, so quietly no vamp on the far side of the room could have heard it. Count said, I yield unto you all my honor. Faster than my eyes could follow, Count leaped from his crouch, going high over the heads of those still standing, to land in front of Sabina, one knee on the floor, both hands touching the floor for balance, his blonde head bent. Mother bless me, for I have sinned. Sabina touched Count's head. You have done well, my son. You are the only warrior to remember the old ways. Not even our once emperor has been so proper. Tidu snarled. Sabina finished. My blessing upon you, Caun of the Celts and of Clan Yellow Rock. And then I remembered a rare codicil of the vampire Carta that dealt with Sangre Duello. All the fighters were supposed to do homage to the clan bloodmaster for whom they fought, and then to any outclan present. No others. No one in their right mind insulted an outclan priestess, yet Titus's warriors had forgotten. So had Leo's and mine, thanks most likely to the fact that weapons had been drawn out of order. Points against both sides. Quickly, Xi and Edmund bowed to me and to Sabina, followed by Titus's people, to their leader, and then to the priestess. Sabina pointed to the octagonals inlaid in the floor and directed the three groups to take their places. J'ai dit merci. Weapons? Single sword, Xi said, sounding bored. Left hand only. I figured it was the Mithrin equivalent of, I'll beat you with one hand tied behind my back. Except that cheating was allowed, so hidden weapons might be used too. Sabina said, Nibolio Mancini, first blood or death. Nibolio was a swarthy, hairy man with a full beard like some Renaissance peddler or fruit seller. To a fight one-handed is cowardly. First blood. This weakling does not deserve to die at my hand. Sabina said, Edmund Hartley, weapons? Two swords, Ed said. No shield. Sabina asked, Simon Costa, first blood or death? Simon was a Renaissance angel with eyes as blue as the sea on a postcard. Death. My heart stopped beating, but Sabina went on. Caun, weapons? Double-headed axes, blades of steel. Lanbrus, Alaphausos, Sabina asked. To death or blood? I withdraw. I do not fight with the garden tools of the pagan and the barbarian. Yellow Rock and Caun, Sabina said. Challenge from Alaphausos is withdrawn, and his name stricken from the Sangre Duello. Death matches to be held downstairs, on the sand rings. Go now and await me. Simon and Ed took the stairs silently. Caun stepped to me, people making way for his broad nakedness, a glint in his eyes that said he had chosen the weapons, knowing that Lanbrus would back out. None of the camera crew was nearby, so I murmured to him, Chief Strategist of Clan Yellow Rock, I said. Nice title. Caun agreed with a tilt of his head and murmured, Battlefield promotion, my master. Self-rewarded. He took his place behind me, next to Eli. The clean bell tone sounded, and I caught a glimpse of a female I didn't know, holding a polished triangle bell and a metal beater. She was strawberry blonde and short with cool green eyes, and she was missing three fingers of her left hand in what looked like a permanent injury, perhaps one from before she was turned. Behind the bell ringer and to the side were most of our non-fighting humans, lined up on benches, eating popcorn and drinking beer. Titus looked that way and his lip curled, more taming of the shrew, go humans. Titus's non-fighting humans were on the far side of the bell ringer, still dressed in formal wear and looking uncomfortable in the sticky winter ocean breeze. Nibolio Mancini and Xi engaged,
left-handed, swords clanking in the first clash. In the next second, G cut off Nibolio's beard and threw his throat. Springy beard hair and blood flew everywhere. Nibolio dropped to his knees. Another vamp dashed in to drag him off the octagonal. For a vamp, it wasn't a lethal wound, but he wouldn't be fighting any time soon. G strolled off. This one had been a 2-second duel.
"Did you get the shot?"
a tiny British voice asked.
"Got it. Golden."
"Bear," the hairy camera wolf answered. "Downstairs," Sabina said. She popped down, as did a larger number of vamps. Humans raced down the stairs. I leaped out the window, landed on the metal roof, only to push off and land on the sand below, balanced on the fingers of one hand and my toes. I pulled on beast speed, my heart in my throat, rushed to the rock-bounded fighting circles. The bell chimed again. I thought I might vomit. Edmund and Simonet both attacked at once. The cage of death that was La Destreza was sketched in the air between them, glistening steel that caught the low lights cut, cut, cut too fast to see. Blood splattered, Edmund bleeding from a cut above the eye. "Holy crap. To the death." "No," I whispered, the word drawn out. Something was wrong with Edmund. He was moving slow. I'd seen him fight, and this wasn't right. He looked almost clumsy. Cowan leaned in and murmured to me, "Strategy, my master. Strategy. Do not fear." I didn't look away from the fight. Edmund took another cut, this one to his forearm. Simon laughed, looking like blonde boy playing a game, not vamp dueling to the death. Their swords whipped and whirled in a complex cage of death, moving so quick they were blurs, cut, cut, lunge, cut, too fast to see, even with beast sight. I shoved my hands into my jacket pockets. My left fist hit something, opened, and encircled it. I had to wonder how the glob got into my pocket. The glob was one of my collection of magical trinkets, and, its name notwithstanding, it was a powerful objet de magie. It was composed of the small sliver of the blood cross that I had ruined for use by anyone but me, part of the iron spike of Golgotha, and the blood diamond, all melded into one. The diamond had started out as an amulet crowded with the power of sacrificed witch children, only a few of whom I had been able to rescue. The glob was magic that had claimed me. Magic that had been fashioned by and activated by my blood and the energy of a witch's lightning curse. The glob heated in my hand, a searing spurt of electric energy, quickly gone. And then I realized that the glob might have found its way into my pocket without help. Magical objects as powerful as the glob sometimes had a will of their own. Ed took another cut, stumbled, dropped to one knee, bent his head, bowed his back, and sliced with a backhanded cut into the outer side of Simon's right knee. He followed it up by blocking two strikes and then delivering a backhanded cut to Simon's side. So hard, so smooth, so perfectly delivered that it appeared to slice through the flesh and stop only when it reached the vamp's spine. Simon, of the funky pronunciation, toppled, dropping his swords. Edmund shifted his body to the side, an expression of shock on his face, as if he hadn't expected to kill his opponent. Playing to the cameras, or hiding what he could do from the EVs. Simon landed. He was nearly in two pieces. Blood pulsed everywhere in a wide spray, puddled beneath his body, soaked into the sand, the air redolent with his vamp smell, wild roses and moss. Edmund struggled to his feet. He took the vamp's head. It took three cuts, wielding the sword like an axe, ungainly, awkward. Not my primo's usual grace and beauty with a sword, not in any way at all. But the head of the beautiful blonde angel rolled to the side. The sand soaked up more blood. The night breeze swept through beneath the house, salty, clean, fresh. The fighting arena was utterly silent for a space of time that lasted for a dozen of my speeding heartbeats. This was the first death, sent out on camera to the entire world. Those who loved blood sports would be whooping it up at home, watching instant